New York headquarters office, and she funded Harriet Stanton Blatch's Women's Political Union to draw more working-class women into the movement, Belmont found the pace of progress too slow. She came to see a more direct path to the franchise in the philosophy of Emmeline Pankhurst. The difference between conservative American suffragists and the new breed of British militants, Pankhurst told Belmont, was, "You talk, we act." Belmont wanted to act, and saw Mrs. Pankhurst's ideas manifest themselves in America in the actions of Alice Paul and Lucy Burns. So when Paul and Burns split off from the National Association to form the Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage, and later the National Woman's Party, Belmont shifted her largesse to the new group, where her money could have more impact and she could have more clout. Belmont became the Woman's Party's primary financial backer. Alice Paul understood that while this generosity provided security, it also came with strings attached. Mrs. Belmont liked to have a strong say in the organizations she supported, and she was used to having her way. Paul was willing to accept the bargain and manage the difficult balance, and even though all policy decisions required Belmont's stamp of approval, Paul was able to keep the headstrong and prickly Belmont engaged while restraining her from taking over. It wasn't easy. In any case, even Mrs. Belmont's donations couldn't float the entire ship, so Paul was forced to plead for money constantly. In contrast, Mrs. Catt had no such money worries. To Sue White's mind, and to the other Woman's Party staff, it seemed so unfair. Mrs. Catt had money to spare and no need to kowtow to any imperious benefactress. Catt was so lucky. Her fairy godmother was conveniently dead. How all this came to be certainly had the trappings of a fairy tale, or a dime novel. In the fall of 1914, Cat was dining with Molly and another friend in their Manhattan apartment when she was summoned to the telephone. Cat returned to the dining table flushed and stunned. "I am an heiress," she announced. The phone call was from an attorney. Cat had been named the major beneficiary in the will of one of the richest women in the nation, a woman she'd barely even met. The woman was Miriam Fallon Peacock Squire Leslie Wilde, Baroness de Bazus, the most admired businesswoman of her day, and a gossip column celebrity who wore scandal like a personal fashion statement. Miriam Leslie crafted her own version of the American success saga with a feminist twist, an ambitious girl from New Orleans, born with neither wealth nor social standing, who by dint of talent, grit, and abundant charm managed to climb the economic, professional, and societal ladders of New York City to become a media mogul of the late 19th century. She made her ascent with ruthless calculation and with panache. She began her career on stage in a dance act with the notorious Lola Montez, managed to enter the circle of America's intellectual elite with her marriage to a distinguished anthropologist and diplomat, then subsequently took up a blue pencil as editor of popular women's magazines. She became an arbiter of taste and fashion, manners and mores for American women, yet her private life was splendidly messy. She married 4 times. Her lovers were numerous. Her affairs, rumored and real, widely reported. After dumping her second husband for her boss, the publisher Frank Leslie, whose eponymous Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper brought a new kind of sensational journalism to America, Miriam seized the helm of the Leslie media empire when Frank died suddenly in 1880. She quickly rescued the faltering enterprise, nimbly reshaping the company, and soon she was among the nation's highest-paid executives, with a yearly salary of more than $100,000. She oversaw 400 employees, and more than 500,000 subscribers read her publications each month. She evolved into that rare creature, a woman in charge of a large corporation and in full control of her own financial and personal affairs. the modern American woman indeed. The kind the antis had nightmares about. Miriam Leslie never joined the suffrage vanguard, but she did quietly support the movement with modest donations, good publicity in her periodicals, and occasionally the use of her office building for suffrage receptions. Carrie Catt had met her just a few times at these events, and they engaged in some conversation, but nothing more. So no one was more shocked than Catt when the phone call came from Mrs. Leslie's attorney in the fall of 1914, notifying her that the Baroness, she'd made up the title and bestowed it on herself, had directed her estate to be given personally to Catt, with the instruction that it be used to further the cause of woman suffrage. The estate was valued at $2 million, an immense sum in 1914, equivalent to more than $50 million today. But it would take almost 3 years of furious legal wrestling for Catt to secure the bequest, as every distant relative and friend laid claim to the estate and tried to make the case that Mrs. Leslie was insane. What else could explain giving away her fortune to the suffrage movement? While Catt was taking control of the National Association and launching her winning plan, she was forced to spend hundreds of hours in probate court hearings and attorney conferences, as well as countless sleepless nights, in her effort to win the Leslie estate. Finally, in early 1917, the court ruled to uphold the will, though almost half of the estate had been spent on legal fees and settlements. Some of the bequest was in the form of jewels. Mrs. Leslie had a weakness for glittering gems, and a trunkful of them was brought to Catt's office at the National Headquarters on Madison Avenue. The trunk lid was opened, revealing a tangle of diamond necklaces and ruby earrings, emerald brooches and sapphire pins. Catt's staff gathered around the treasure chest, and she motioned to them to come touch the jewels, touch the legacy of the woman who was buying the future for them. For a magical half hour, the suffrage soldiers played dress-up, sashaying between the office desks in bejeweled splendor. One of the staffers picked up a diamond-studded tiara from the pile and placed it on the silver curls of Carrie Catt's head, crowning the chief. After a while, Catt clapped her hands and signaled for the jewels to be returned to the case. It was closed and latched, and immediately sent off to be sold. Catt used the Leslie money to finance the 1917 New York suffrage referendum campaign and her winning plan, building a stronger central command base in New York and opening Suffrage House in Washington to lobby for the federal amendment. She established the Leslie Woman Suffrage Commission, which supported the Leslie Bureau of Suffrage Education, a sophisticated publicity and publication department, with a press bureau pumping out news articles distributed nationwide, the Woman Citizen magazine, thousands of pamphlets and educational materials, and the History of Woman Suffrage volumes. The Leslie Woman Suffrage Commission was also underwriting the costs of the National's ratification campaign and the formation of the new League of Women Voters. But even now, in summer 1920, Carrie Catt's fight for the Leslie money wasn't over. Another distant relative had recently filed suit to overturn Catt's claim on the estate, contending that Catt had somehow bewitched Mrs. Leslie into bequeathing her fortune to suffrage. Catt had to again wearily deny this, but the suit was going forward. The Leslie money hadn't exactly come without cost, not without a mighty amount of travail and headache and worry. But it had come, and Catt was grateful. Catt paid tribute to Mrs. Leslie every week, in every issue of The Woman Citizen, where above the masthead was placed a bold-bordered box containing a dedication to Miriam Leslie and her faith in the irresistible progress of women. Mrs. Catt and Marjorie returned to Nashville on Thursday afternoon, August 5th, the day of the Tennessee primary. Men around the state were going to the polls, All of the candidates expressed full confidence that they would win their contests. The results of the primary would determine who'd held on to power, who'd won it, and who had lost it. Governor Roberts' future, and his attitude toward ratification, would hopefully be clarified. He would or would not call the special session. The men who won the vacant seats in the legislature could tip the ratification polling numbers, but no one really knew. Kat looked fatigued and had pale, dark rings under her eyes. She moved back into her room on the third floor of the Hotel Hermitage. In her absence, the hotel had filled with more antis. Mrs. Ruffin Pleasant had arrived, wife of the former governor of Louisiana, and, as Josephine Pearson described her, the daughter of Major General Ector, who had 3 horses shot under him at the Battle of Lookout Mountain. Pleasant and her husband had been instrumental in defeating ratification in the Louisiana legislature, and they'd come to Nashville to apply their skills in Tennessee. Many more antis from around the country were expected soon. There was little to do but wait. Upon her return, the weary Cat, who could have no fonder wish than for a quiet nap under the ceiling fan, found in her hotel mailbox a galling note from Josephine Pearson. It was the paper equivalent of a slap of white gloves on her cheek, a challenge to a duel. Having warmed up with her scalding letter to James Cox, Pearson enjoyed turning her rhetorical flamethrower toward Cat, challenging her to a verbal duel, a public debate, against the anti's knight-errant Charlotte Rowe. Taking the role of a proper second in the code duello, Pearson laid out the offenses Cat had committed. "We have no objections whatever to your crying to Governor Cox for help, but when you have made a sweeping general charge meant to discredit Tennessee men and women and their distinguished invited guests, we demand a bill of particulars." The tone of the note was sarcastic and taunting. "We would not for the world convey the impression that we have any objection whatever to your presence here, for Southern courtesy, as well as confidence that your presence here is helping us, would prevent our making such objections." But Pearson demanded that Cat debate Rowe to allow the people of Tennessee to decide for themselves who is more inspiring, and no excuses or evasions would be acceptable. Cat would not lower herself even to reply. Cat did take a moment to write a quick note to Clara Hyde in New York. "I've had 2 rocky days, and can only say please pity and pray for the cause, and for me." After the polls closed, once the ballot boxes were opened and the votes counted, Banner reporters telephoned the latest tallies to the newsroom. A squad of editors there relayed these hot-off-the-wire numbers to a team of typists, who sent them on to a projectionist, and the progress of the races was projected onto a screen hung across the street from the newsroom. A crowd of hundreds gathered on Commerce and Third Streets to witness the marvel of breaking news flashed before their eyes in the darkness, and they stood mesmerized, watching the numbers on the screen, until close to midnight. By Friday morning, it was clear that Albert Roberts had prevailed over William Crabtree to win the Democratic gubernatorial primary by a comfortable margin of more than 20,000 votes, and Alf Taylor had overwhelmed Jesse Littleton for the Republican nomination. Abby Milton and Catherine Kenney were disappointed by Roberts's victory, and Sue White thought that Roberts's win afforded a slight advantage in securing ratification, as now his forces cannot claim lack of influence as an excuse for inaction. But all the suffs were relieved to hear that most of the men elected to fill vacancies in the legislature were pledged to ratify. Late on Saturday afternoon, August 7th, Governor Roberts confirmed or confounded the rumors. He formally called the General Assembly to meet in extraordinary session beginning at noon on Monday, August 9th. The decisive confrontation. Anticipated. Relished. Dreaded. Was finally set. It would begin in less than 48 hours. Chapter 16. War of the Roses. All through the weekend, all over Tennessee, the men of the legislature were packing their bags, closing their shops and offices, canceling vacations, kissing their wives and children goodbye, and boarding trains. They might be gone for a few days or for 3 weeks, the full term of the session. No one could tell. The delegates who lived in the more remote sections of the state, where phone wires hadn't yet been strung or electricity service didn't yet exist, wouldn't receive Governor Roberts's call to convene until Sunday or Monday, and would have to scramble to make their way to the Capitol. They stormed into Nashville aboard steaming trains, riding the iron horses that had made the city great. Mercury was a busy god during this weekend, greeting the hundreds of men and women pouring into Union Station to attend the special session. He watched over everyone pulling into the station, the legislators and lobbyists, politicians and partisans, correspondents and conspirators, all the participants in what the newspapers were already calling the Tennessee War of the Roses. And Union Station was a crazy place. The special session was most especially a boon to florists. Arriving passengers were met by welcoming parties of women who pounced upon them and attempted to pin a rose to their lapel, an anti-red rose or a suff yellow rose. Yellow or gold had long been the American suffrage campaign's symbolic hue, signifying the flame of freedom's fires. The Woman's Party adopted a version of the British suffragists' tricolor of green, white, and violet-purple, a chromatic acronym for Give Women the Vote. And the Antis had more recently adopted a patriotic red-blooded motif. A Tennessee delegate had to be careful about which color rose he accepted as his boutonniere. But whichever he chose, he would know no peace. Josephine Pearson and Nina Pinkard were at the Hotel Hermitage, striking a pose for the camera. As the photographer set his bellowed Graflex camera on a tripod and fiddled with his flash, the women practiced their positions, standing at the doors of anti-ratification headquarters on the mezzanine level of the hotel. Red, white, and blue bunting, as well as miniature American flags, adorned the entrance, and Pinkard clutched a polished wooden pole bearing a large Confederate battle flag. Pinkard was dressed all in white, from her hat to her shoes, a single red American Beauty rose pinned low on her breast. Pearson wore a dark dress and flat-brimmed hat, three red roses on her bosom. Between the standing women was seated a very old, frail, white-mustachioed man. When the photographer's flash exploded, it caught Pearson turned toward Pinkard, the corners of Pearson's mouth upturned in a satisfied half-smile, her roses illuminated by the burst of light. Pinkard took a more assertive, defiant stance, her right arm outstretched upward, holding the corner of the stars and bars, spreading it out to its full glory behind her. Sitting beside her, sharing a grip on the flag's long pole, was the wizened man, wearing a bow tie and waistcoat, a huge rose pinned to his suit jacket. He was William Absalom Crutcher, a proud Nashville veteran of the war between the states, a living symbol of all those who fought and bled for Tennessee's states' rights, whose sacrifice, the members of the Southern Women's Rejection League wished to remind everyone, must not be squandered. The Confederate veteran was just a boy when he joined the celebrated Tennessee Cavalry Unit led by General Nathan Bedford Forrest. He served as a scout, and all his life he was honored to belong to the Forrest Group of Confederate Veterans. The banner of the Forrest Veterans was displayed prominently in the photo, hanging down from the Stars and Bars pole, and this was very much on purpose. The banner was a signal, a silent whistle, to any Tennessean. General Forrest was popularly known not only as the Wizard of the Saddle, for his lightning attacks on Union forces, but also as the brutal commanding officer at the Fort Pillow Massacre, where hundreds of surrendering Black Union troops were slaughtered by Forrest's men. Forrest was also famous as a founder of the Ku Klux Klan, one of its first Grand Wizards. The photo made all the historical connections, raised the emotional stakes, expressed just what Pearson and Pinkard wanted it to convey. Pearson wrote a caption for the photo, displaying both her erudition and her heritage, saluting Jefferson Davis's use of poet William Cullen Bryant's battlefield hymn as a Confederate motto, "Truth crushed to the earth will rise again." A few floors above, Carrie Catt knew that Harriet Upton had arrived when she heard a booming laugh echo down the Hermitage hallway. That was Upton's distinctive laugh, and Catt was very glad to hear it. Upton, president of the Ohio State Suffrage Organization and recently appointed vice chair of the Executive Committee of the Republican National Committee, had been dispatched by Will Hayes to demonstrate the party leadership's concern about Tennessee, and also to placate Mrs. Catt. Catt had also wired a personal plea to Upton, at home in Warren, Ohio, to hasten to Nashville. Upton was needed to straighten out the Republicans. Catt and Upton had been suffrage colleagues for 30 years. Upton liked to joke that she discovered Catt, then a young, unknown Iowa delegate, to the National American Woman Suffrage Association's 1890 convention. Catt had delivered an impressive speech on Iowa's progress, and when the news reporters asked Upton, acting as publicity director for the convention, to identify the striking, dark-haired lady who'd just bowled over the audience, Upton admitted she had no idea. Needing some vital statistics, Upton passed a note to Catt. "Who are you? Where were you born? Where educated? What have you done? Are you married?" Catt penciled quick answers to each query. "Born in Wisconsin, educated in Iowa, did newspaper work in California. Am married. He is in the back of the hall. Am not a big gun, never will be. Carrie Chapman Catt." And that, Upton liked to say, was one of the only instances she knew Carrie Catt to be absolutely wrong. Upton, like Catt, had been one of Aunt Susan's girls, and Anthony had valued Upton's adroit political sense as well as her jovial nature. Besides her organizational and networking abilities, Upton had a talent for winning friends for the cause with her good humor, and could diffuse tense situations with a witty aside. Upton served on the National Association's board, was its treasurer for years, and for a time, its headquarters was actually located in Upton's house in Warren. Upton was comfortable with the rough and tumble of politics. Her father had been an Ohio congressman, and she'd accompanied him on the campaign trail as well as to Washington. She also knew the ins and outs of Ohio political affairs. Besides her Republican Party activities, she was in the thick of four failed attempts to convince the Ohio legislature to submit woman suffrage to a popular vote, had led two unsuccessful referendum campaigns, 1912 and 1914, succeeded in obtaining presidential suffrage from the legislature in 1917, only to have it repealed, and piloted the effort for Ohio's ratification, which was still being challenged by the antis. She'd faced off against the powerful liquor interests in her state time and again. She knew both Warren Harding and Jimmy Cox quite well. In her role as head of Ohio Republican Women, she'd attended the Harding Notification Day, seated on the stage behind the candidate, while Alice Paul, Louisine Havemeyer, Anita Politzer, and Sue White watched from the far reaches of the pavilion. She knew Harding wasn't the strongest of suffrage champions, but she believed he was sincere, and she was in Nashville to convince Republican legislators that Harding and the party needed them to ratify. Catt was delighted to see her comrade. Upton was a large woman and equally big-hearted, pragmatic but tender, with a depth of experience few could match. Catt could be candid with Upton, rely on her judgment, and relish her wickedly funny riposts. She could use some humor just now. But Upton was also an outsider, another Yankee, and Catt was beginning to realize the double-edged nature of all her stinging, outsider accusations. The antis were having a fine time throwing them back in her face. As a countermeasure, Kat now gave the signal to the national headquarters to release to the press the small southern good luck charm she'd been holding, a letter addressed to the men of the legislature of Tennessee from Lady Astor, the first woman to take a seat in the British Parliament. Nancy Astor was born a Virginia girl, one of the beautiful Langhorne sisters of that proper southern family. No outsider, she. Kat had requested the note, and Lady Astor had gladly obliged. "I want to send a message to the men of the South, because I come from the South, and feel that I know and understand it, as one only can understand the place of one's birth and childhood," Astor wrote. "I know the strong sense of justice and honor that lives in the hearts of the people. I know their chivalry, too. And it is just because I appreciate that chivalry that I, as a woman, am anxious that it should be representative of the present, and not only of the past. That it should be a progressive chivalry, equal to the needs and aspirations of the women of today, not content to give merely what was demanded of it in the old days. 35 states have given their hand and seal in ratifying the federal amendment, but one is lacking. Will not the South give that one? Remember, we are making a new world, and women, mothers, long to have a share in the sort of world in which their children must live. We have moral courage and spiritual vision. Give us the chance to help you." Whether Lady Astor's plea had any real effect upon the legislators of Tennessee is questionable, but it helped drive home Kat's point. The whole world was watching. Over the course of the weekend, as the opposing armies massed and the legislators assembled, the lobby of the Hotel Hermitage became the central gathering spot, the place to meet, talk, and argue, cajole or confront friends and foes. It was neutral, but hardly tranquil ground. The bizarre grandeur of the space, its soaring marble columns and ornate vaulted ceiling, the swags, garlands, and rosettes carved into the wall borders, the Persian carpets below and cut-glass chandeliers above, gave a sense of both gravitas and gaiety to the animated conversations transpiring in the lobby. For more sensitive planning or clandestine plotting, the rattan chairs in the airy loggia, or the dark banquettes of the lower level, men-only grill room, were favored. By Saturday afternoon, the lobby was thrumming with conversation. Sun rays slanted through the painted glass skylight, bathing the room in a rosy glow, illuminating the puffs of tobacco smoke wafting above the feathered and flowered hats of ladies and the bare heads of linen-suited gentlemen. As viewed from above, from the balustrade of the lobby's mezzanine level, the number of anti-red roses seemed to multiply with each passing hour, swelling like a scarlet bloom of algae over the Tennessee marble floor tiles, overwhelming the smaller islands of yellow. The antis were descending upon Nashville in force. Mary Kilbreth, president of the National Association Opposed to Woman's Suffrage, had come in from New York on the Saturday morning train, joining a brigade of anti-leaders landing throughout the day. Dolly Lamar from Macon, a leader of the Georgia Association Opposed to Woman's Suffrage. Winifred Wise of the Maryland Anti-Suffrage Organization, Francis Williams from Virginia, and Harriet Frothingham from Boston, president of the Massachusetts Antis, along with several of her associates. Beatrice Shillito, a leader of the Ohio Antis, was comfortably settled in a room at the Hermitage and had already delivered a rousing speech to an appreciative audience at Nashville's George Peabody College for Teachers. Dozens of anti-representatives from other states were on the way. Expected on Sunday morning were Laura Clay of Kentucky and Kate Gordon from New Orleans. Their arrival promised to be especially delicious for the antis. Male anti-suffragists, displaying all the chivalry expected of them, took up their positions on the ramparts. Augmenting the team from the American Constitutional League, who'd already arrived from New York and Baltimore, were Ruffin Pleasant, former governor of Louisiana, and James Pinkard of Alabama, joining their wives. Judge John Tyson of Montgomery and Martin Lee Calhoun of Selma also made the trip. Two Maryland lawmakers traveled to Nashville on a mission to persuade their fellow lawmakers to emulate Maryland in rejecting the amendment. Besides these visitors, Tennessee's own antis emerged from every corner of the three grand divisions to make their way to Nashville. They were heeding the call, "To arms! To arms!" that Josephine Pearson and her colleagues had issued earlier in the week, a summons presented in stirring verse. "They are knocking, 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 knocking at your gate. Will you permit them entrance, women of this state? Come rally to our standard, come show your pride of race. Beneath our unfurled banner, come take your rightful place." Everyone understood who they were. The call to arms was printed in the state's major newspapers, mailed to sympathizers, and distributed through clubs and churches. It reminded the citizens of Tennessee of the larger issues at stake in this ratification fight, the threat that the federal amendment posed to states' rights, the dangerous precedent of Negro woman suffrage, and the frightening potential of racial equality. It asked Tennesseans everywhere to don red roses to show their support, and to gather in Nashville beneath the anti-banner, the stars and bars that Nina Pinkard and Josephine Pearson had unfurled at the doors of their headquarters. Those polished wood doors of the anti-headquarters swung open at exactly 5 o'clock that Saturday afternoon for the welcoming reception. Josephine Pearson was a most gracious hostess, greeting her guests at the door while making sure the punch bowls were filled, the tea pitchers chilled, and the cookie trays replenished. Volunteer women from all the finest families in Nashville served as pourers and servers. The tables were beautifully appointed, and the room was decorated in the proper red floral hue. Nearly 200 guests circulated around, chatting and quaffing, admiring the array of posters and broadsides, the assortment of informative brochures, and the museum exhibits. There were, as promised, examples of the force bills that Congress could use to enforce the voting provisions of the 19th Amendment, as well as, the antis warned, the 14th and 15th Amendments. Congress had never yet exercised its power to protect black male voters from their blatant disenfranchisement in the southern states, but ratification might trigger a reassessment of that hands-off policy, the anti-materials warned, and reopen the horrors of Reconstruction when black men voted, and several even served in the Tennessee legislature. But the highlight of the exhibition was a dusty book, an 1895 first edition of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's Woman's Bible. It was a thick and homely tome whose bland exterior belied its power to provoke. The book was Stanton's attempt to prove that the Bible, as interpreted by men and practiced by mainstream religions, had deliberately kept women in a subservient position, hindering their progress for millennia. Stanton had solicited contributions from women of different religious outlooks for this compendium of commentaries on scripture with a feminist slant. She'd also invited suffrage leaders to contribute, including Carrie Catt, but most declined to participate in what they considered Mrs. Stanton's folly. In the end, Stanton wrote the majority of the commentaries herself, in her signature, biting, and entertaining style. So Carrie Catt was flabbergasted to find her name listed as a member of the book's revision committee when it was published. She'd never written a word for it. The book had become a huge bestseller in 1895, and a severe headache for the suffs. It was, not surprisingly, denounced from the pulpit and in the press as the work of Satan. Stanton's position as honorary president of the National dragged the organization, against its will, into the squabble. The book's more blasphemous statements, that the Bible was not the divine word of God, but the creation of men, and that prayers ought to be addressed to an ideal heavenly mother, offended devout suffragists as well, and spooked potential members, hurting the National Association's membership drives. The younger women in the movement, including Kat, decided something must be done to limit the damage. At the next annual convention, they introduced a resolution denouncing the Woman's Bible, disassociating the National from Stanton's book, and censuring its author. In addition, Kat insisted that her name be removed from subsequent editions. But the antis had a first edition. And there it was, printed on the frontispiece of the volume in the ceremonial display. They labeled it Mrs. Kat's Bible. At the proper moment, Miss Pearson stepped onto a small, raised platform to make the formal remarks of welcome. Her years as a teacher stood her in good stead now, as she effortlessly commanded her audience's attention. She saluted the guests of honor, all the visiting anti-leaders who'd come to defend Tennessee and the Southland. She led an ovation for the legislators wearing the red rose. She introduced the speakers, offering testimonials and pep talks. It was one of the most exciting moments of her life. Nina Pinkard, Charlotte Rao, and Mary Kilbreth spoke for the women antis, exhorting anti-suffragists of all stripes to join hands in defeating the amendment. Senator Walter Cameron of Marion County, near Chattanooga, spoke for those legislators who felt that it would violate their oath of office to vote on ratification in the special session. He'd voted for limited suffrage in 1919, he explained, but he would not vote to ratify the amendment. This was just the sort of switch the Suffs feared. There was spirited applause. Another senator stood apart from the crowd, surveying the scene, listening to the speeches with only desultory interest. Lon McFarland was a lawyer who represented Wilson County in Middle Tennessee. Tall and dapper, favoring white linen suits, Panama hats, and string ties, he had a reputation for a sharp tongue and hot temper. He wasn't at all pleased about being dragged back to the State House in the middle of summer, and he didn't like being badgered about where he stood on ratification. He'd voted for limited suffrage in 1919, even supported it on the Senate floor with a little speech saying that a man would trust a woman with his name and his honor and with the rearing of his children, and there was no good reason why he should not trust her with the ballot. He was of two minds about this federal amendment. He could be persuaded by either side, but in any case, he wasn't going to broadcast his intentions, and on his lapel he wore his own small bicolored rosebud, tinged with both red and yellow petals. He enjoyed the look of confusion on people's faces when they saw it. McFarland was not impressed with what he heard. As he strolled out of the party, the senator from the bluegrass horse country of central Tennessee was overheard to say, "That bunch of fillies was the longest on pedigree and the shortest on looks that I ever saw." The Suffs stayed for the most part in their rooms, occasionally sending spies into the lobby, who noticed one curious thing. As the evening wore on, there was a steady exodus of men, wearing both red and yellow roses, from the Hermitage lobby, through the brass doors of the elevators, and up to the eighth floor. And they didn't come down. The Suffs were mystified. Early on Sunday morning, August 8th, aides to Governor Roberts bounded up the steps of the Capitol building for a scheduled strategy session with House Speaker Seth Walker. Roberts had appointed his young and progressive superintendent of public instruction, Albert Williams, to coordinate the administration's ratification efforts in the legislature. Williams, whose father had once been mayor of Nashville, supported woman suffrage for both idealistic and, as he called it, selfish reasons. In his experience, women cared more deeply about the education of their children, and if women could vote, they would likely make education a priority and force the state legislature to appropriate more money for schools. That was good for the children, good for the state, and also good for Williams's education department. Williams eagerly accepted this tricky assignment from his boss, who, since winning the primary 3 days ago, seemed more enthusiastic about getting the federal amendment approved. It wasn't exactly a spiritual awakening, more of a political reckoning. Roberts realized that while he might have won the primary, his rival had won a goodly proportion of votes. The state Democrats were still fractured, and Republican Alf Taylor had made a strong showing. If he had any hope of winning the general election, he would need the support of the National Democratic Party and candidate Cox, and that meant proving to them that he was willing to put his own skin in the game to secure ratification, for the good of the party. Realistically, he also wanted the votes of Tennessee women, should the amendment go through, and he would gladly accept their electoral gratitude for championing their enfranchisement. His closest advisors were still vehemently against ratification, arguing that his support for it was tantamount to political suicide. He would incur the wrath of not only the rabid states' rights and Bible-thumping folks, they screamed at him, but also powerful corporate interests, both within and out of the state, which viewed woman suffrage as a wrench thrown into the economic engines propelling the New South. Roberts listened to his advisors' objections. Admittedly, they had some solid points, but he overruled them. Roberts knew what he had to do. He had to ram this ratification thing through the legislature. His protege, Seth Walker, would carry the ball in the House, Andrew Todd would guide it through the Senate, and Albert Williams would make sure it made it over the finish line. He had his team. With the special session slated to open the next morning, Albert Williams had requested a meeting with Seth Walker to analyze the latest poll of the House, see where the various delegates stood, who might cause trouble, who needed convincing. In the last session, Walker, the governor's close ally, had adroitly maneuvered the administration's legislation, even the most contentious bills, smoothly through the chamber. He was a whiz at such things, and Walker was on board for ratification. He'd joined the men's ratification committee, pledged to vote aye, and accepted the invitation to introduce the ratification resolution in the House, lending the prestige of the speakership to the effort. Now the game plan needed to be perfected before the opening tomorrow, even if it was Sunday morning and everybody should be in church. Williams and his deputies sat in the executive offices in the east wing of the Capitol building, going over the delegate lists, shooting the breeze, waiting for Walker to show. Walker was late. They waited for an hour and more. Finally, Walker marched in, flushed, agitated. He'd had a change of conviction, he announced to a startled Williams. He'd decided to oppose ratification, and the governor was courting political disaster if he continued to support it. With that, Seth Walker turned on his heel and walked out the door. On Sunday afternoon, a caravan of 40 shiny touring automobiles drove from the Hotel Hermitage out to Washington Hall, Mr. and Mrs. George Washington's country estate outside Nashville. The society pages of the newspapers called it a highlight of the summer social season. If women of refinement must be plunged against their will into the muck of politics, Queenie Washington and her hospitality committee believed, they should at least endeavor to retain the feminine social graces. An elegant garden party for the antis was the proper thing to do. The Washingtons' grand house was decorated with fragrant flowers from their garden, and the buffet table was graced by a bouquet of pink roses in a silver bowl. Among the guests sipping tea on the porch or strolling on the manicured lawns were many prominent Nashville ladies and gentlemen, sympathetic lawyers and businessmen, willing legislators, and all the distinguished anti-guests from out of state. Freshly arrived from Lexington was Laura Clay, whose charm and witticisms made her a popular conversation companion, and Kate Gordon, just off the train from New Orleans, both sporting red roses. They were the women Carrie Catt most dreaded encountering. They were once her sisters in arms. Clay still treasured a photograph of herself standing together with Aunt Susan and the other nieces outside their mentor's Rochester home in 1900, the young women, including Clay, Carrie Catt, Harriet Upton, and Anna Shaw, the National Association's new executive board, were poised to take over from Anthony to lead the movement into its next phase. At the moment that photo was taken, Clay had already given almost 20 years of her life to the cause and would devote nearly another two decades beyond. Her presence at the anti-garden party was a painful coda to a distinguished suffrage career. Clay was the great gardener of Southern suffrage, planting and nurturing suffrage societies in many states. She led the Kentucky suffragists for nearly a quarter of a century, and became the leading Southern voice within the Executive Council of the National Association. Gordon was a New Orleans public health activist who believed women's voice in government was the key to societal betterment. Both women were convinced that the South would accept woman suffrage only if it could be aligned with the region's larger political goals, regaining state sovereignty and retaining white social and political hegemony. The votes of white women could secure these goals. Clay and Gordon urged the National Association to adopt a Southern strategy in promoting state-based woman suffrage, where local custom would determine how the franchise was achieved and implemented. If they chose to be racist, that was their decision. Catt, in her first term as president, acquiesced to this program in hopes of keeping the peace and softening the South for suffrage work. But in subsequent years, when Clay and Gordon and several other Southern suffragists insisted that explicit white women-only clauses be added to any suffrage proposals, the National Association, regaining a modicum of its moral fiber, rejected their policy demands. In response, Gordon and Clay created the Southern States Woman Suffrage Conference in 1913, promoting woman suffrage as a solution to the race problem, with the franchise bestowed only by the states and only upon white women. A secret sponsor of their new group was Alabama-born Alva Belmont, who wrote a big check and an encouraging note. She understood the peculiar conditions of her homeland and believed Clay and Gordon's approach might work in wringing woman suffrage from Dixie state houses. Ironically, at the very same time, Belmont was also bankrolling Alice Paul's upstart congressional union. She was financing a state suffrage-only approach with one hand and a federal amendment-only goal with the other. Whatever might work. But the Southern Conference didn't last long. When hope and work for the federal amendment was revived in 1916, Clay and Gordon were dismayed. They wanted the ballot, but they wanted it their way. On the day the U.S. Senate finally passed the amendment in June 1919, Clay resigned from both the National Association and the Kentucky suffrage organizations, and she and Gordon turned their energies toward thwarting ratification. 6 weeks before, in June, they joined forces to fight ratification in Louisiana, where their awkward alliance with diehard antis, the ones who hated the idea of women voting at all, proved successful, even if distasteful. That same alliance was now assembled in Tennessee, and they were all sipping lemonade together on Mrs. Washington's lawn. Queenie Washington stood on the top step of her porch to thank her guests for coming. This was an exciting time, she told them, and at last the antis were poised for victory. And, she said, smiling, she had more happy news. The Southern Women's Rejection League had just received a cable from Governor Cox granting them a meeting. Following the garden party, she and Mary Kilbreath, as well as Nina Pinkard and a small delegation, would be boarding the night train to Dayton and meeting with Cox the following day. They would convince him to throw his weight toward defeating ratification. Before the party ended, Mrs. Washington assembled a group of Rejection League women and their guests for a family portrait, posed on the porch steps of Washington Hall. Josephine Pearson was given a place of honor in the front row, alongside Nina Pinkard and Mary Kilbreath, near Laura Clay and Kate Gordon. Men in summer suits stood among the throng of women, and some of the more daring younger ladies sat perched, cross-legged, on the porch's stone parapet. They all looked very happy. The most exciting news, that of Seth Walker's defection to their side, was not yet public and couldn't be celebrated at the garden party. But there were surely a few guests who knew all about it and had good reason to smile for the camera. In the moments following Seth Walker's stunning reversal and abrupt departure from the Capitol, Albert Williams and his staff seemed shell-shocked. They slowly gathered their wits and phoned the governor at home. Roberts and Williams spent the rest of the day figuring out what to do, how to respond, how to control the damage. They tried to reach Walker, to reason with him, but his mind was set. Whatever, or whoever, had caused Walker to so suddenly change his conviction wasn't clear, and without a firm grasp of the rationale, the governor didn't have much leverage to threaten or force him back into line. Roberts and Williams knew they had to keep a lid on all this, keep it from circulating around town, and certainly keep it from the press as long as possible. It was embarrassing, a demonstration that the governor was not in control of his allies, much less the legislature. It was a sign of his weakness. How could he explain this to Cox or to President Wilson? He needed time to think things through, to come up with an alternate plan. But this had to be the worst time and the worst place, a city crawling with political operatives and journalists, to try to keep a secret. By evening, the governor's efforts to win back Seth Walker had come to naught, and his normally scowling face, he rarely smiled, took on a look of abject dismay. His anxiety soaked through the words of the telegram he sent that night to Charles Ormond Williams, the Memphis school's superintendent who'd recently been named vice chair of the DNC's executive committee. Charles Williams was in Dayton. She'd attended Cox's acceptance speech on Saturday and was about to depart for Nashville to help in the ratification fight. Before she stepped onto the train, Roberts asked her to deliver an urgent message to Cox. Suffrage situation very critical. Amendment will fail unless every possible effort is made to adopt it. Powerful organizations actively fighting it. It seems that the whole fight has centered here, and I suggest that you apprise Governor Cox of the critical situation and of the necessity for doing everything possible. Certain influences here are making the fight very difficult. Certain influences had gotten to Seth Walker. The governor braced himself. How many other legislators would follow Walker into the anti-camp? On Sunday night, with the opening of the special session just hours away, the chief faced her nervous field commanders. Assembled in her Hermitage suite for an intense strategy and intelligence briefing were the directors of all the different ratification committees, the Democratic women, Republican women, the Men's Committee, and the League of Women Voters. Anne Dudley, Harriet Upton, and Marjorie Schuller were there, too. Sue White was not. White viewed her position in Nashville as the ambassador of an autonomous organization, a sovereign power, distinct from the workings of the National Association. She would cooperate and coordinate with the National Association SUFs as necessary, but she would fly the Woman's Party's own flag and take direction only from Miss Paul. Even if she'd been invited to Mrs. Katz's room for the briefing, she would have refused. The chief took charge, acting as the Professor cum general. She assumed both roles naturally, from long practice, always the teacher. She'd long ago established training schools for suffrage organizers around the country, and that summer, tens of thousands of women were reading her syndicated Mrs. Katz citizenship school lessons in local newspapers, providing instructions on the workings of government and the democratic process, preparing women for the vote. Now she had to prepare her warriors to win the vote. Kat reviewed the overall strategy, to maintain pressure on the presidential candidates and national parties, lean on state party leaders, keep close tabs on the legislators, and push for a quick ratification vote while the delegates still remembered their pledges and before they could be enticed to change. "We are ready for a vote," Kat had told reporters earlier in the evening. "Enough men have promised to vote for ratification to put it over, and there is no necessity for delay." The antis, she understood, would be throwing every possible obstacle and motion to delay into the amendment's path. "If the Tennessee Solons stand by their pledges, ratification of the 19th Federal Amendment is certain," Kat told the press. "I believe the favorable poll will stand." But the women gathered in Mrs. Kat's room on Sunday night were, with reason, worried about that qualifier, if. The Tennessee Suffs had spent the weekend assiduously socializing, greeting the delegates at the train station, chatting up the politicos in the Hermitage lobby. They were hearing things, rumors, gossip, inside information that disturbed them, about men changing their minds, planning to renege on their pledges, pledging both ways, or fixing to not vote at all. The reporters circulating around town were hearing these murmurs too, and were writing cryptic allusions to mysterious influences and certain vague, nameless forces. These forces, the papers said, are reputed to have the unlimited financial backing of certain interests, which are opposed on principle and through interest to woman suffrage. Anne Dudley did her best to neutralize all the dark, spooky rumors swirling around the city on Sunday, emphasizing her faith in the integrity of the Tennessee legislature. "Knowing its personnel as I do, and the high standard of the great majority of its members," Dudley told reporters, "I feel no hesitancy in saying that in a question involving the national honor, as this question of political freedom for women undoubtedly does, they will vote aye." "Pshaw," countered the antis. "We know that pledges extracted under coercion and over-persuasion have no direct value," Nina Pinkard told the banner. "A man will sometimes pledge a woman, as he would marry her, just to get rid of her." On the eve of the legislature's convening, Sue White was trying hard to project the image of a calm and courageous commander, someone unfazed by the heat of the fight, the model Woman's Party warrior. But she struggled to hide her terror. White was staying in the Hermitage now, to be closer to the center of action, and from her room she wrote her daily roundup report and wired it to Miss Paul. "Speakers Walker and Todd will introduce resolution. Republican caucus called tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Nobody will say how bulk of Republicans will vote. Some reports antis using money, and other reports that pledged men will not all show up. If Republican caucus not favorable, only desperate chance winning as governor's forces doing nothing." The Suffs did not yet know of Seth Walker's betrayal. Downstairs in the Hermitage lobby, a strange sort of beauty pageant was underway. Anti-headquarters had been alerted that the prettiest young Suffs were being deployed to mingle with the legislators in the lobby. And they were, as one reporter put it, clad in the daintiest creations of the modiste, and evidently making an impression. Alarmed, the antis summoned a bevy of their own comely supporters, all dressed and dolled to the limits of present-day fashions, to counter the Suffs' onslaught of pulchritude. Legislators certainly did not mind being caught in this middle, cajoled by cute representatives of both sides, and the Hermitage lobby was a smoky paradise for the uncommitted lawmaker. The meeting in Mrs. Kat's room continued as she delved into the details of the battle plan. Each woman would be assigned to track certain legislators. The local women who had gone out into the field to pledge the delegates of their districts would continue to ride herd on them. Leaders of the various ratification committees would act as liaisons to the men who answered to their constituency. And only Tennessee women were to lobby the legislators, attend sessions in the galleries, or even set foot in the statehouse. The Suffs under Kat's command agreed that they would present 100% Tennessee pure face in the Capitol. Only those who possessed the proper volunteer state pedigree and spoke with a correct regional drawl would be placed in the front lines. Mrs. Cat and Mrs. Upton agreed to remain in the background, consulting